Good morning and welcome back. So today we have a lot of things going on. I'm just really glad that you're here, and let's just open in a word of prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you that you are our Father. Lord, our only earthly fathers and mothers fail us, but you are our good Father. Thank you for each one that is here today, and as we open our hearts and we share from our hearts and we learn, just pray that you will speak to us deeply and we will come away changed. In Jesus' precious name, amen. So, Laurie is going to introduce and just give us a little bit of a personal story. So, Laurie.
Morning. So, I'm Laurie, and I was part of the planning team for this retreat, and you know, it's really my privilege to be doing this introduction and just share how we came up with this and kind of our brainstorming process through meetings. When Nancy invited me to be a part of the planning team, I really saw this as a time to really bring a little bit more hope to the community, especially for families with young children. I remember when my kids were little, it was an incredibly challenging time for life for me, and especially the first 2 years of Lily's life. Corey was working full-time at a church and going to full-time seminary an hour away from our house. Lily didn't sleep through the night for the first 2 years of her life, and Jaren was randomly hitting other kids and attacking other children, and we had no idea why or what was going on. And I just constantly felt isolated, judged because of Jaren's behavior, and completely exhausted because I didn't sleep through the night for 2 years. This was a really dark time of my life and of isolation for me. I was constantly feeling judged and also, like I said, exhausted. But in this church, I see a real opportunity to make this life stage different for the families here than it was for me. And I was really excited to be a part of planning this so that we could do that. I also see it as a community that's passionate about facing and naming struggles we have so that we might struggle together rather than alone. A lot of those struggles couldn't be taken away from me, but it would have been great to have other people to struggle along with. So through all of these hours of discussion as our team, we worked to find the right topic and the best way to move to a deeper community as a church, and to really relieve that struggling and isolation. So we came up with the topic of family systems because we really believe that it's at the heart of how we were parented, how we will then parent, and how we function within the CAN community as family members. As you will hear, or if you didn't already figure out from last night, family systems can quickly put us in a place of seeing the mistakes and wounds caused by our own parents, grandparents, and even lineage further back. While it may be an uncomfortable place to be, we couldn't help but see the importance of sitting in this discomfort. To help better understand the topic and feel that I could contribute to the conversations in our meetings, I read the first section of Generation to Generation by Edwin Freeman, which introduces family systems. With a traumatic childhood myself, I realized quickly that it was not going to be an easy read, and I wasn't going to be able to do it until I shed my desire to only see what my parents did well in raising me. I had to find a way to read this and not hide the obvious issues that set the stage for dysfunction, nor allow it to create anger and resentment toward my parents. I had to acknowledge that my parents did their best and to this day love me with all their capacity, but still failed gloriously in some crucial areas. I also had to be aware that my love for my children, I love them to my complete capacity, but I too am unconsciously setting the stage for dysfunction and can only stay teachable and open to allowing new information to change my parenting and other relationships. Recently, I've started reading the book Ishmael on Laura's recommendation. The premise is that a highly intelligent gorilla named Ishmael put an ad in the paper for a student who has an earnest desire to save the world. The main character goes to meet the gorilla, and after a long description from Ishmael about his life behind the bars, he tells his pupil that the topic he plans to teach him is captivity. The student is confused and says, "I'm trying to figure out what this has to do with saving the world." The conversation continues. Ishmael thought for a moment, "Among the people of your culture, which do you want to destroy the world?" the student. Which want to destroy it? As far as I know, no one specifically wants to destroy the world. And yet you do destroy it, each of you. Each of you contributes daily to the destruction of the world. Yes, that is so. Well, why don't you stop? The student shrugged. Frankly, we don't know how. You're captives of a civilizational system that more or less compels you to go on destroying the world in order to live. Yes, that is the way it seems. So, you are captives, and you have made a captive of the world itself. That's what's at stake, isn't it? Your captivity and the captivity of the world. Yes, that's so. I've just never thought of it that way. And you yourself are a captive in a personal way, are you not? How so? Ishmael smiled, revealing a mass of ivory-colored teeth. I hadn't known he could smile until then. I said, I have an impression of being a captive, but can't explain why I have this impression. Ishmael says, a few years ago, you must have been a child at the time, so you may not remember it. Many young people of this country had the same impression. They made an ingenious and disorganized effort to escape from captivity, but ultimately failed because they were unable to find the bars of the cage. If you can't discover what's keeping you in, the will to get out soon becomes confused and ineffectual. Yes, that's the sense I have of it, Ishmael nodded. But again, how does this relate to saving the world? The world is not going to survive very much longer as humanity's captive. Does that need explanation? No, says the student, at least not to me. I think there are many among you who would be glad to release the world from captivity. I agree. What prevents them from doing this? I don't know. This is what prevents them. They are unable to find the bars of the cage. What are our bars that keep us from being the parents, grandparents, aunt, uncle, that will stop the captivity for our children? I want to invite you to join me in finding these bars, not to blame or judge, but to be freed from captivity.
Thank you, Lori. Very excellent introduction for today. So, how the morning's going to go is Pastor Jin is going to share, and we're going to pass out a couple of documents. There's two documents, and make sure you get one of each. And this is just some references of terminology and some things that, if you want to make some notes on there, and on the back of one page is some questions that we're going to look at afterwards, if you just hold on to those for later when we get into our small group. So Pastor Jin is going to share, and we'll have some time for question and answer, so please jot down, and as you saw the format last night, we certainly want this to be interactive, so if you have questions, be prepared to speak them out, and we will address them. And so then we'll have small groups, and we're going to have a testimony a little later from Shane and Renee, and we are going to have a coffee break at 10:45 and some awesome snacks and a little more discussion. Then lunch will be at lunchtime, about noon to 12:45. And then this afternoon we'll have another testimony from Kendra and Daniel and another small group. So lots to come. And Pastor Jin, I welcome you.
Thank you, Nancy and Lori. Wonderful. Good morning, family. Good morning. Isn't it great to be with family on a Saturday morning? Don't you just love this family?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Almost every single one of you. Just kidding. All right. I'm so glad that Lori mentioned the book Ishmael. That's the ultimate differentiation. Like, if we want to stand on our own 2 feet on God's good green earth without having a codependent relationship with this civilization, so-called civilization that we've constructed, that would be a very good book. There's a man named Bowen. I forget his first name, but the Murray Bowen, thank you. He's kind of the innovator. Shane and Bowen are on first name terms, looks like. Right. So Murray Bowen is a kind of an innovator in family systems theory, and it's now a sprawling kind of a field, and many, many great people have contributed to understanding family systems in that way. And I myself have, as an Asian person, been surprised by how effective it has been in giving us a power of explanation, because a lot of things that make sense in one cultural context isn't as relevant in another. But in my own family work and pastoral ministry, it has been really useful and helpful. In the congregational context, a Jewish rabbi named Edwin Friedman wrote a book called Generation to Generation, and it is the seminal text on family systems theory as applied in congregational context, whether Christian or Jewish. And a lot of how we do our emotional work here in this church is based on that book. So it's, all of this is not a mystery. There's wonderful people who've come before us who have helped lay the foundation for some of the ways that we live out our relationship here. So I wanted to, I wanted us to look at this family systems terminology first. It's kind of helpful to be on the same page in terms of our vocabulary so that when we speak, we're generally talking about the same thing. And special thanks to Dana, who helped put this together and brought in some of the best resources. Dana has a tremendous amount of expertise in this area. So we benefit so much from local experts in our own community. And I don't think this is in any particular order. Is it, Dana?
No.
Okay. So first, well, this, like I said, in no particular order, emotional triangle. Have you ever heard that term? Like, don't triangle me, all right? But an emotional triangle is formed by any three persons or issues. The basic law of triangles is that when any two parts of a system become uncomfortable with one another, they will triangle in or focus upon a third person or issue as a way of stabilizing their own relationship with one another. A person may be said to be triangulated if he or she gets caught in the middle as the focus of such an unresolved issue. So two people will be talking, and it's not that they have a bad relationship, but they might not have the relationship that they're seeking, and in order to deepen that relationship, they might talk about a third person. And now, it doesn't really matter whether they talk well or poorly, but usually it's poorly because that's how we human beings are. And when two people kind of agree about this third person, there is kind of this sense of camaraderie and trust and intimacy and agreement, and it actually releases, you know, like pleasure chemicals in our brain, endorphins, to, you know, in that exchange. And then that this third person who's not even part of the conversation is a live participant without knowing. You've heard the term, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. It's kind of like that concept. And you'll see that aspect of codependence is often talking about somebody else with real emotion, right? And because somehow that feels like stabilizing to us. So it's just an unfortunate feature of codependence, but it's something to watch out for. And when we find ourselves doing that, if one of us can, if not both, if one of us didn't at least stop and say, maybe we need to take a process break and ask what we're doing and why we're talking about this other person. What is it that we're avoiding about each other? And how do we establish a direct relationship with each other and go deeper in intimacy and community without triangling somebody else into it? You know, we'll see this later, but often parents achieve a sort of unity by triangling one of their children, right? So if any of you have ever been a problem child, What is a problem child? It's more likely a problematized child is would be the more honest way of saying it, right? And we'll get into that a little bit further here, but that's one of the earliest triangles, is when a husband and wife actually are not in agreement about most things and are arguing, but they do argue that they have a problem child, or they have a problem parent, or they have a problem something else, and it brings a kind of unity, stabilizing unity, seemingly stabilizing unity in that marriage. All right. Differentiation of self. We've talked about that a lot already. Families and other social groups tremendously affect how people think, feel, and act, but individuals vary in their susceptibility to a groupthink, and groups vary in the amount of pressure they exert for conformity. So a people pleaser would be basically a kind of a regular way of talking about a non-differentiated person, right? These differences between individuals and between groups reflect differences in people's levels of differentiation of self. The less developed a person's self, the more impact others have on his functioning and the more he tries to control, actively or passively, the functioning of others, right? Controlling behavior. People with a poorly differentiated self depend so heavily on the acceptance and approval of others that either they quickly adjust what they think, say, and do to please others, or they dogmatically proclaim what others should be like and pressure them to conform. So, this groupthink, this pressure to conform is so strong that we either do whatever, deny our own self to conform to groupthink. It could be as small as a nuclear family, it could be large as an entire society or civilization, or if we want to insist on our way, then we try to get other people to conform to us so that it feels like we are standing on a kind of a broader consensus. So if other people think like I do, surely I must be okay, right? So we try to manipulate other people into our emotional sphere so that we can feel propped up by community. So this is a strange thing. All human beings are born for community. We're not born to be isolated individuals on this earth. As I said, that is a particular ideological construct. We're born for communities. But if we are not differentiated in a healthy way, then we will either conform ourselves in an unnatural way to a group or try to coerce other people around us to become the community that we need. Third, nuclear family emotional process. The concept of the nuclear family emotional system describes four basic relationship patterns that govern where problems develop in a family. These are marital conflict, dysfunction in one spouse, impairment of one or more children, emotional distance. Four, homeostasis or balance. And homeostasis, just want to say right now, is different from equilibrium. Homeostasis is the need for a family to enforce sameness and balance, especially in times of stress. The tendency of any set up relationship to strive perpetually in self-corrective ways to preserve the organizing principles of its existence. Especially in times of stress, relational systems naturally put energy towards keeping things the same. If the relational systems become unbalanced, this may result in a symptomatic member showing symptoms. So homeostasis just means keeping things the same. It doesn't mean like a healthy balance or anything. And this is kind of what I was referring to last night when I said that when one person in a codependent family system tries to stand up straight and put the weight on the ground, it creates unbalance or it disturbs the homeostasis of how the family was functioning. Even if a family is dysfunctional, it has been functioning in a dysfunctional way. You see what I'm saying? I work with cars a lot because we get cars donated to the church and I try to make cars work for our people. Transportation is a really important part of people's lives. And one thing I've learned is in some really, really old cars, there's kind of a balance among really worn out parts. But if you replace just one part, it can create havoc in all the other parts that are used to this one part functioning kind of, halfway. So if you replace that one part, all the parts actually have to be replaced because they're all kind of in the system together. And this is one of the things, like when one person really differentiates in a healthy way, it can create massive dysfunction in other people who react to that. So homeostasis is a real thing, and this is one of the, it's naming a powerful invisible force that runs counter to our desire to be a healthy, differentiated person. We will run up against the forces of homeostasis that have kept the system locked in place. However dysfunctional it is, it still works in a strange sort of way. 5, identified patient or the symptomatic members. And now there's a description of that term. A family member has been unconsciously selected to act out the family's inner conflicts as a diversion. The identified patient as the family member with the obvious symptoms is to be seen not as the sick one, but as the one in whom the family's pathology has surfaced. This concept emphasizes the position rather than personality when explaining the emergence of a symptom. Isn't this an incredibly precise definition? And in just a few lines, describes so many of our dysfunctions. So the problem child, or the black sheep, or the scapegoat, but basically one that there's a consensus in the family system that this person is the problem. Just remember that what it means to be an adult is learning the social skills to hide our dysfunction and to control ourselves from acting out. What it means to be a child is not having learned those filters, so they just act out, right? And that's why adults drink. All right. Six, family projection process. The family projection process describes the primary way parents transmit their emotional problems to a child. The projection process can impair the functioning of one or more children and increase their vulnerability to clinical symptoms. Children inherit many types of problems, as well as strengths, through the relationships with their parents, but the problems they inherit that most affect their lives are relationship sensitivities, such as heightened needs for attention and approval, difficulty dealing with expectations, the tendency to blame oneself or others, feeling responsible for the happiness of others, or that others are responsible for one's own happiness, and acting impulsively to relieve the anxiety of the moment rather than tolerating anxiety and acting thoughtfully. So this is a kind of a description of what a healthy family looks like, but that most often doesn't happen. Many of us don't grow up in a way, in a differentiated way, and we basically we're like a screen, we're like the projection screen, and our parents project their dysfunction onto the children. So we have the responsibility, the privilege of healing from that and differentiating, standing on our own 2 feet, or else we're gonna lean into our children in that codependent sort of way and project our dysfunctions onto them. That's just how it happens. By the way, this codependence is a very broad spectrum. So there can be emotional codependence, where we're leaning into our children with all of our unresolved expectations. And physical and sexual abuse of children is just part of the spectrum. That's like really leaning heavily into them and intruding into their lives and space in a you know, really horrible and grotesque way. But physical and sexual abuse are part of the spectrum of codependence. It means needing our children for our own well-being. That's ultimately exploitative. So what it means to have children is for them to be part of the abundance of love between human beings. When there is love between two human beings and there's an abundance of love in that relationship, then children are part of the sharing of that abundance. But if we're not getting our needs met by God, by church, by spouse, and then now children are one more effort to try to find equilibrium, then you can just see that we're using our children. They're not there just as recipients and sharers of love and human community, but they're one more thing that we're trying to grasp at to find our own equilibrium. Children figure that out sooner or later. And they actually figure that out really soon. And as we said earlier, don't have the filters to stop from acting out on that. So the projection process, to go on a little further, follows three steps. One, the parent focuses on a child out of fear that something is wrong with the child. Two, the parent interprets the child's behavior as confirming the fear. And three, the parent treats the child as if something is really wrong with the child. These steps of scanning, diagnosing, and treating begin early in the child's life and continue. The parent's fears and perceptions so shape the child's development and behavior that he grows to embody their fears and perceptions. One reason the projection process is a self-fulfilling prophecy is that parents try to fix the problem they have diagnosed in the child. For example, parents perceive their child to have low self-esteem. They repeatedly try to affirm the child, and the child's self-esteem grows dependent on their affirmations. 7, multi-generational transmission process. The concept of the multi-generational transmission process describes how small differences in the levels of differentiation between parents and their offspring lead over many generations to marked differences in differentiation among the members of a multi-generational family. The information creating these differences is transmitted across generations through relationships. The transmission occurs on several interconnected levels, ranging from the conscious teaching and learning of information to the automatic and unconscious programming of emotional reactions and behaviors. Relationally and genetically transmitted information interact to shape an individual's self. 8, emotional cutoff. I'm not sure I understood that myself. That's why I'm moving on. I think it's just saying that stuff gets passed on generation to generation, right? Yeah.
It sounds like it's like it gets passed on, but then it also sounds like if like, say you have a family that one member of that family works a little bit more on their differentiation, it will make a big difference for their kids versus their cousins or something like that. Is that kind of maybe part of it?
I think so. I think Kendra got it. We could go with that. Yes, Becky Jo.
My family of origin is a great example of emotional cutoff because emotions were to be controlled at all times. I laughed too loud. I cried too much. So every time I did that, my parents shut it down. And so even today, I have a very hard time with when am I being too emotional, because I have to, and I still live with my family, so it's still going on, I'm still dealing with it to some extent. So.
Yeah, well, that's a good introduction. I'll just read that right here. The concept of emotional cutoff, number 8, describes people managing their unresolved emotional issues with parents, siblings, and other family members by reducing or totally cutting off emotional contact with them. Emotional contact can be reduced by people moving away from their families and rarely going home, or it can be reduced by people staying in physical contact with their families but avoiding sensitive issues. Relationships may look better if people cut off to manage them, but the problems are dormant and not resolved. By the way, emotional cutoff and triangulation are closely related. One way to, develop some kind of rapport with people that you're kind of emotionally cut off and say, isn't Trump crazy? And that's a way of triangling in somebody else that we don't even know to establish some kind of rapport. But yes, the emotional cutoff is what we do in order to try to find ourselves and be ourselves, it's not a good long-term strategy, because differentiation is how you get there, not emotional cutoff. But it is a recognition that we were emotionally cut off first in childhood, and we need to excavate those memories so that we understand what happened. Becca Jo just gave a great example of one way that emotional cutoff happens. I've counseled someone who told me that he was spending the day with his father, and it's not a good relationship. And that day, he was just crying a lot. Happened to be in public, and when he got in the car with his dad, was just beaten all the way home. It was like a pretty long drive. And then when there was a stoplight, was beaten with both fists, right? And said, "You are never to cry in public or cry at all." And he will say that he basically had tears beaten out of him so that he can't cry now as an adult. This is a serious issue, because laughing and crying are very much part, a very, very normal part of our human range. And when one cannot physically cry, there is a blockage happening. So we're, working for that to be released one day. But that is a really harsh example of an emotional cutoff that happens when we're young. Then guess what that creates? Emotional cutoff with the parents, like having very, very little to do with each other, except the most basic formalities. And this is why life events like, okay, someone's getting married, there's a funeral, there's a graduation, there's a bar mitzvah or a baptism, and I gotta go home, it creates such a crisis because the emotional cutoff's not been resolved. 9, sibling position. People who grow up in the same sibling position predictably have important common characteristics. I thought it was great that the Wranghams last night brought in their sibling position and how that influences their relationship with each other and children and other things. But that's a really important part of all this. 10, underfunctioner, overfunctioner. That was mentioned last night as well. Underfunctioner. The term is used to describe people who are less successful than our optimally functioning person at life management, fulfilling roles, and making decisions. Underfunctioners, UFs, often rely on others to manage things for them, have problems maintaining progress on goals. So, UFs, not FUs. Just gotta get that straight. Overfunctioner. All right. An overfunctioner, on the other hand, hold on. This person can be seen as taking more than 100% responsibility, more than 100%, that's ridiculous, of his or her own life, plus various amount of that from UFs. Overfunctioners, OFs, are usually seen as people who have it together, are detail-oriented, organized, and reliable, and are typically viewed as being reliable workers, partners, and parents. Yep. In other words, annoying people in our lives. Amen. Amen, says an overfunctioner. And often overfunctioners and underfunctioners find each other, and that's what marriage is, right? Amen to that. How would we function if these two types of people didn't come together? And it's just, it can be a helpful match, except when we universalize our tendencies as good, right? Rather than seeing it as our particular, the particular ways that we've been shaped, and really see the value of the other. That's definitely the case in my marriage as well. And don't need to say which one of us is which, but embracing the other is part of that. And 11, societal emotional process. And I think this gets back at some of the things that Lori was talking about earlier from Ishmael. Each concept in Bowen theory applies to non-family groups such as work and social organizations, even an entire civilization. The concept of societal emotional process describes how the emotional system governs behavior on a societal level, promoting both progressive and regressive periods in a society. Cultural forces are important in how a society functions, but are insufficient for explaining the ebb and flow in how well societies adapt to the challenges that face them. All right. I want to stop here and just ask if there are, among ourselves in this CAN family, you have examples that you want to lift up that describe some of these processes in your own life that you want to like just share with each other or ask what that is and explore together as a family if you're comfortable doing that. These are all like technical terms, but they're just like real life relational situations that we've put technical terms onto.